stories from around the corner.
And around the country.
You're listening to All the Best.
Proudly supported by the Art Gallery of New South Wales.
You're listening to All the Best from FBI Radio 94.5. I'm Madhura Prakash. Before we get into this week's stories, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that I'm recording from stolen Gadigal land and pay my respect to Gadigal elders past and present, and also recognize that the area where FBI Radio is situated, Redfern, has long been a place of storytelling, strength, resistance, and resilience for First Nations communities. This week, we're sharing stories that deal with matters of the heart, or more specifically, heartbreak. Do you remember your first heartbreak? I'm sure you can recall the feeling, but what does the memory make you think about yourself, the heartbroken person? During the immediate aftermath of my first romantic heartbreak, my answer would have been absolute self-hatred. One less person loved me, and that made me worthless. Even the $10 breakup app that my therapist told me to download didn't help with the feeling that there was something very wrong with me. A couple of years after, I would express mortification when thinking about the heartbroken person. I would cringe when thinking about the texts that I sent or the spiraling conversations I would have with friends. But now, a few years later, I look back at that person with a lot of compassion. Maybe it's because my memories of the time have faded, or it's the benefit of more years of life lived. Whatever the case, I have a lot more understanding of that teenager now. When listening to this week's stories, I have a feeling you'll also look back upon your past. You'll think about words that you regret or actions you would undo. And when that happens, I hope you give yourself a little bit of grace. And remember that the years will pass. Our first story explores the way that memories of a relationship can replay in your mind, over and over, on loop.
It's been months, and I'm still replaying our conversation in the car. I'm changing the script every time. Your hands at 10 and 2, my nails picking at their polish. The indicator keeps the rhythm of our silence, and it isn't awkward or uncomfortable. You ask about my sister. I say, I don't know. I say, she's fine. I say, she's sick again. You offer sympathies and ask about my mother. I say, she is how she always is. You say, that's mother's. You tell me about yours, how she was your first love. I say, that's mother's. I say nothing. I ask about your parents. You remember you are still somebody's child. You talk about your father with more forgiveness than I do. We say, that's father's. I say, I hope your mother is well. You say she isn't. I say, I hope she is soon. You say it isn't a matter of hope. I make a note to pray for her. We sit at the lights. Your hands at 10 and 2. I ask you about work. You say, there's nothing to tell me that you haven't already. You ask me about work. I say the same thing I always do. I say, it's good. I say, I want to quit. I say, It could be worse. You say I could be famous. I say, I've always had this sneaking feeling I would be. Someday. I laugh it off. I say, I will pay for your retirement when I am. We sit at the lights, my nails picking at their polish, elbow out the window. You say your dog is sick again. So casually, like he is just a pedestrian and not a loved one. I don't know what to say. I don't say anything. I say, I'm sorry to hear it. I say, I hope the vet doesn't drain you. I say, he'll come through. I place my hand on yours. You don't say anything. I adjust my sunglasses. I fold my hands into each other. We sit at the lights. The indicator keeps the rhythm of our silence. I ask if you've heard the new album. We put it on. The bass in our thighs, the harmonies in our chest, this is our religion. I ask if you've seen the new episode. You have. We talk the spoilers out of ourselves. We talk about our friends, how much cooler and smarter and more put together they are than us. We agree. We miss them. We sit at the lights. It isn't awkward or uncomfortable. You talk about the new album. We both love the end of silence. We both love the music. We let ourselves marinate in it. The bass against our thighs, the harmonies in our chest. This is our religion. I say, traffic isn't so bad when we're sitting in it together. I say, I would sit with you in any lifetime. You say, me too. We don't say anything. We sit at the lights. Your hands at 10 and 2, my nails picking at their polish. The indicator keeps the rhythm of our silence. It isn't awkward or uncomfortable. I want to reach out to you. I don't. I want to ask about your mother. I don't. We want to look at each other. It has been so long. We don't. The light turns green. You ask about my mother. I say she is how she always is. You say, that's mothers. We arrive where we need to be. I say, goodbye. I say, see you soon. You say you hope so. You say you love me. I say, I love you more. I say, thanks. You say, no problem. You say, anytime. I say, see ya. You say, nothing. I change the script again. I can't remember the original. I play it back. I play it back.
That story was written and performed by B, with sound design by Gregory Thorsby. The supervising producer was Phoebe Adler-Ryan. Find more of B's work by following them on Instagram at byb_. Up next, our storyteller looks to escape the echoes of a past relationship by ridding themselves of their last physical reminder.
The day I called Paul from Paul's Half Price Storage and Removals, I was circling, like a hammerhead shark.
How did you get my number?
Well, it's listed as a business on Google Maps. I was hoping to store a couple of boxes with you.
I sort of had to put that project on hold because it wasn't really working out.
He sounded almost guilty. I let him sit in it. Come on, Paul. Don't let me down.
But if it's just a few boxes like you say, I reckon she'll be right.
Gotcha. Earlier that day, I had tried and failed to relocate the boxes to a storage facility with all the trappings of a legitimate national corporation. White, fluorescent-lit corridors, locked units, 24-hour access, security, insurance, policies. It all seemed very promising at first, but I made the critical mistake of showing my cards too soon. I have some boxes to store for my former housemate. He's interstate. He'll collect them when he's back in town. The woman at the front desk did not exactly say,
"We are unable to accommodate your request because people in a semi-disassociated state depositing items on behalf of the ex they desperately want to forget tend not to stay up to date with payments, eventually leaving us to deal with all of their boxes of whatever the fuck."
I went back to my Toyota Corolla to scream and refocus on how I was going to finish the day with an empty boot. I gripped the steering wheel and tried to think, my knuckles turning white. It was only a year after the thing happened, and I was still vibrating too fast behind the eyes to see that maybe I didn't have to get this done today. Maybe it would be worthwhile to do this right, even if it meant the boxes followed me to my new house, even if it meant contacting him again and waiting to organise the Kennards-approved paperwork, and that maybe the boxes themselves weren't the ones making me. But I couldn't slow down enough to see any of that. And then I stumbled upon Paul, and just like that, there was blood in the water. Paul's enterprise was hidden away in a cul-de-sac in a semi-industrial area. There was no signage. The job of declaring the nature of the establishment left to the mounds of debris that surrounded the warehouse. I surveyed the rolls of mouldy carpet, rusty bed frames, washing machine drums, various car parts and odd bits of metal spilling out of the yard and onto the footpath like decaying fruit in a Greek cornucopia. It seemed promising so far. At this point, it appeared unlikely that Paul had a receptionist on his payroll, but just as I was reaching for my phone, an ashen-faced man in a Pikachu onesie sauntered out of the building to throw an entire slab of beer in the recycling bin. Somehow, all the tins were empty, yet still yoked in their plastic rings. I wondered what purpose this arrangement might have served. "G'day, I'm looking for Paul."
Yeah, maybe try around the back."
Pikachu gestured lazily to the patch of green where the warehouse backed onto a train line. I tried round the back, and sure enough, Paul, the patron saint of junk, emerged from a pumpkin patch, long legs wading through the grass in yellow waterproof pants, so flaky they seemed to be disintegrating in front of my eyes. He was wearing a navy blue woolen sweater and a beanie, with bits of greying hair poking out from underneath it. He carried himself with a stoop and an air of awkward determination. I liked him immediately.
Hi, Alex, is it? You had a couple of boxes?"
He didn't quite meet my gaze. "Yes, Paul. A couple of boxes." As soon as we entered the dimly lit warehouse, my heart leapt. There was not a tidy white locker in sight. Instead, temporary fencing had been erected to divide one person's stuff from their neighbours, and the amount of stuff was truly overwhelming. It was definitely the kind of place you could lose a couple of memories in. "How come you decided to put the business on hold?" I hope the question sounded innocent enough.
"Well, because people eventually stop paying, and then they never come back for their shit."
"Oh, no kidding," I replied, eyeing a pile of CDs stacked jauntily on top of a dusty wardrobe. Paul led me into the desolate, sprawling metropolis of long-forgotten objects. The sections were arranged haphazardly, and our path snaked through the dark, dusty labyrinth of grey and brown until we reached an open fence. Paul gestured to an empty pallet with possum shit on it. It was perfect. I told Paul as such, hoping my delight wasn't as palpable to him as it was to me. Since our phone call, I'd been attempting a brisk, breezy manner, hoping to distract both of us from my guilt and several thousand other emotions I was barely aware of. My guilt. Was that what it was? What did I have to be guilty about? Sure, I had misled Paul as to my precise reasons for needing to store the boxes. I fed him something about my partner and I downsizing and only needing to store the boxes for a month or so. But I had no reason to believe my ex wouldn't pay or eventually come to collect them. He was reliable, if nothing else. I was suddenly hit by the image of him coming here, to this place, to pick up his stuff. A shiver ran up my spine. I shook it off and placed the boxes on the pallet, reapplying myself to the job of acting normal. This isn't even that big of a deal, I thought, my stomach churning. Once again, Paul ushered me through the darkness of the garbage warren, this time into a relatively airy section of the warehouse. The sun filtered through the skylight, illuminating where Pikachu and his friends were lazily dancing to trance music. I briefly considered the fact that it was 11 o'clock on a Tuesday morning and regarded the dancers with a mix of disdain and quiet longing.
Give us a minute. I'll go grab the paperwork.
I watched Paul as he walked off to the back office, his shoulders folded around his chest. What was it like holding on to all the things that others want to forget? Would my boxes add much to his burden? It was impossible to believe that they could simply just be boxes to him. No. Surely the dark aura surrounding the boxes was tangible to everyone, even if only subconsciously. The almost predatory glee I had felt when I first found Paul was starting to give way to something heavier. Still, it is what it is, I thought. There's only so much I can hold on to. He quoted me a figure of $10 per month and handed me the contract, essentially a scrap of paper with his personal bank details on it, requesting that I write down my name and phone number on a post-it note. I realised then that Paul wasn't so much a businessman as an experimental jazz musician, improvising freely.
Now!
Paul fixed me with a stare, making direct eye contact for the first time since we'd met.
Just please make sure it gets picked up. Don't leave it here forever.
Of course. I'll never set foot here again, I thought. On the way out, I was buzzing with relief, asking Paul if he ever sold anything from the scrapyard, saying how much great stuff there was, that I might be able to use something for a project in the garden, and generally acting as if I was going to develop some kind of ongoing patronage of his business. I smiled when I got back to my car, resting for a moment. Thank you, Paul. My boot was empty. It was done. I don't exactly remember returning to Paul's half-price storage and removals a few weeks later to retrieve my ex-partner's boxes and move them to a secure locker at Kennard's. But I know it happened. I have the emails to prove it.
That place sounds dodgy. Please move my stuff to the storage facility listed below. I have attached the paperwork. Please do it soon, as I'm planning to come to Melbourne in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
How had he cottoned on anyway? Maybe the fact that I could only supply a mobile number for a man with a recently unlisted business. Leaving his boxes on that dusty, shit-covered pallet in storage purgatory was the closest I could get to setting it all on fire. It let me honour my thirst for retribution while appeasing my fear. But my symbolic revenge only lasted for 2 glorious weeks before the email came and reminded me that I was still afraid. Still, it was fair enough, wasn't it? He wanted his stuff. He wanted it stored safely. He wasn't being unreasonable. He wasn't the unreasonable one in the relationship. I didn't hear from him again after that, and I didn't have to think about the boxes. It was all in his name, and finally, out of my hands. Some months later, I was driving up Bell Street and passed the Kennard self-storage facility, all primary colours and clean edges. I felt a jolt in my stomach and my eyes unfocused slightly. There's nothing in my boot, I told myself, like a mantra. There's nothing in my boot. There's nothing in my boot. There's nothing in my boot.
That story was written and performed by E. Coffey, with sound design by Gregory Thorsby. E played Alex, Gregory played Paul and Pikachu Man, and Jay Chaplin played the X. The supervising producer was Phoebe Adler-Ryan. In our final story, we hear a breakup across 12 parties.
12 parties without you. The first party was hard. Swirling my limp drink, answering my friends one by one when they asked me, "How are you?" The second party seemed better. Someone talked to me about subduction, elevators, silt, trivia of geology that I'd never heard before, would never hear again, but that for one night ran new ideas through my head. A man smiled at me. He was nothing, but the smile was good. Then I told my friend Patricia about us. She fell into tears. She had to sit down her wine. I almost broke. The third party seemed like the hardest. It wasn't the hardest. We were together in name. You, by the bathroom, talking with our Game of Thrones friends. Me, by the door, greeting and goodbying and trading cool pleasantries on weight, on earrings and on kids. We passed each other, once and briefly, in the kitchen. You said hello, I said hello, you walked on, I did too. The fourth party, I saw my sister across the room. She smiled at me, and I frowned a little, so she twisted back to me a question-marked frown. I smiled. She frowned more. I smiled more. She twisted her drink at me. I drank up and smirked little bubbles. I wanted to tell you. You weren't there. I can't tell you anymore. I have to remember. The fifth party, he smiled at me again, out the back door, among leftover cigarettes and empty cans. He almost kissed me. When I went home, I was filled with fire, a white fire inside like wind. The sadness is there still. It is the colour of pitch, long like a howl and has no end. But now I have fire as well. The sixth party was in a tiny flat. It was so tight that even though I know you didn't bring her, I knew about her, and her presence was crushed into a presence all on its own, like Superman crushing coal into a diamond by your side with sharp edges. And every time I got near you, it cut me. Nothing is sharper than that. The seventh party, I saw him, but he had to leave early. I got his number. I'm not sure if I'm ready for his number. I feel like I'm losing my marbles. There's some space inside me where you used to rattle, the emotional ballast you used to give me. What would you say if I asked you if I should go with him? You would say, go. You have her and it suits you that I should be happy. You would say, I'm not yours now and you are not mine. I am not yours now. You are not mine. We had an orbit, you used to say. Like marbles. Like planets, I'd say. Like marbles on Einstein's trampoline, you said. I got it. But I didn't think it was very funny. You are not mine. No stupid jokes. No marbles. All my gravity is gone. He wasn't at the eighth party. Everyone was talking on eggshells. No one said, how are you? They just said hi. Their eyes still narrow. It passes. It's been months. I texted him and smiled. He He took me to the 9th party. We giggled, drank, and I drove him home. At the 10th party, I was scared to see you. In the end, you snuck in while I was piling dips onto my dipping bread. By the time I turned around, you were gone. I looked for you. You flicked away a speck of hummus from my lip. I looked at the door. I glanced at him and I was full of an anger I couldn't explain. By the 11th party, I was through with him. He had no grace under fire and I was aquiver with sharp words. At that party, I saw you with her. You kissed. I was cold and I felt nothing. I smiled then. But at home, at night, by myself, I cried. The 12th party was easy. You weren't there. I didn't think of you. I ate some pizza. When they opened up the door for me to go home, they asked me whether I was going home. I looked out the door. I could go anywhere, I thought. All by myself.
That story was read by Bethany Atkinson Quinton. It was written and produced by Zasha Rosen. Music was by Dave Goldschmidt. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past and present. All the Best is made at FBI Radio on Gadigal land, in association with SYN and 3RRR on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Boon Wurrung lands, and 8CCC on Arundi and Warramungu lands. The All the Best editorial producer is Mel Bakewell, and Phoebe Adler-Ryan is our executive producer. Our social media producer is Isabella Lee, and our social media assistant is Seth Emmerich. Patrick McKenzie is our community coordinator, and Janae Madden is our content assistant. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and were made possible by the Art Gallery of New South Wales and the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find our full archive of more than 500 episodes at allthebestradio.com. I'm Madhura Prakash. Thanks for listening.